Here we go. We are in the 24th chapter, Perek Chaf Dalet in Mishlei. Chaf Dalet in Mishlei. And we will be picking up with Pasuk Vav. Continuing our interesting discussion about planning. Okay, different things last time. We talked about last time we talked about drinking alcohol. No, didn't we talk about that? I don't know if it was last time or two times ago. Either way. Yeah, that was two times ago. All right. This time, let's start with Pasuk Vav. Pasuk Vav starts, Ki b'tach bulot ta'asa l'cham el'chama. Ki b'tach bulot ta'asa l'cham el'chama. Because with a lot of thinking and deliberation or strategy, you will make a war. With strategy, you'll make a war. What do you think that means? Ki b'tach bulot ta'asa l'cham el'chama. In the art scroll, for through wise strategies you can wage war for your benefit. So I think the operative word to understand this pasuk is the word lecha. The word lecha basically means that through strategies it'll be for you. It'll make for you a war. So for you almost implies like it's a good thing. Like it's a good thing for you. But the end of the pasuk makes it sound a little bit different, because the end of the pasuk says "Usishua berov yoetz," and salvation will come through the abundance of counsel. So it almost sounds like the first half of the pasuk is you're getting yourself into trouble, and the second half of the pasuk is you're getting yourself out of trouble. I don't know that for sure, but that's the impression that I get. So if we're going to go with that explanation. So what is the first part of the pasuk telling us? Ki b'tach bulot, with strategies you will make war. I think this refers to the fact that sometimes you will overthink things, right? Ki b'tach bulot. Tach bulot are strategies. You're sort of deliberating, should I do this, should I do that? And once you introduce sort of like the heavy, you know, strategic thought process, you know, where it's kind of like, okay, I got to make a decision. I've got this thing to do. I've got that thing to do. So once you start doing that, so then you're creating a war. You're creating like a lot of tension, a lot of struggle, internal struggle. Now, sometimes that's warranted if it's a big decision. But oftentimes, you know, I think we don't realize that sometimes just asking questions that are unnecessary will cause us unnecessary stress. You know, I remember there was a mentor of mine that once had a whole sort of diatribe about toothpaste. And it sounded funny, but he says, like, if you ever go to buy toothpaste, yeah, right? So you have a lot of different options. You have the one for whitening, mm-hmm, and you have the one for anti-plaque, yeah, and then you have the one for gingivitis, mm-hmm, and then you have the one, the total, 360 does everything for you. Then you have the gel. Then you have the paste, right? Then you have the anti-cavity. You know, the way he says is that, what, you're going to come home with a tube of anti-cavity and tell your family that they have to deal with gingivitis. Mm-hmm. You're going to come home and with the anti-plaque and say, sorry, you're going to have cavities. You know, so we go to the toothpaste aisle and we drive ourselves crazy because of it, right? And the way that he used to say it, the way that my mentor used to say it is, you know, after 120. You only have 1/2 hour, you know, you could have had 1/2 hour left to bless your children, and you have to say to them, sorry, I spent that 1/2 hour in toothpaste aisle. I can't bless you because I spent that 1/2 hour in toothpaste. And you can't bless your children. Now, obviously, that's a over-dramatic way of looking at it. But I think a lot of our commercialized world has become like that. You know, decisions might not have been as plentiful, but they made for a simpler life before the commercial era. Now, I'm not saying we should go back to the non-commercialized era, but what I'm saying is we have to think more deliberately, not just about the decisions that we make, but even the decisions that we consider to be made. You know, sometimes decisions are not worth the stress. Should I get this olive oil or that olive oil, this one? just virgin, and that one's extra virgin, and that one, you know, should I get, you know, this chocolate bar, that chocolate bar? And we sit there, like, twiddling our thumbs. There are so many more important things to do in the world. But more important than just, you know, balancing priorities, which is definitely important, you're creating undue stress for your life. Like, why does it matter if you buy that fish or that fish? You know, what does it matter if you wear that pair of socks or this pair of socks? Sometimes I get caught up in those things. Like, is anyone really looking at your socks? You know, obviously, it'd be like a mensch, you know, wear nice socks. But, like, no one cares if you wear the blue ones or the pink ones or the whatever. Like, just put on socks. Like, and it's a real thing, you know. A few books I haven't quoted in a while talk about this, The Power of Habit, Atomic Habit, I think how to Make a Change, by Katie Milkman. They all talk about the same types of things, which is like, try to get rid of having to make the silly decisions before doing something important. You know, so they say that people who put out their exercise clothes for the morning after, but they put the clothes out and ready to go the night before, are much more successful at exercising, actually getting to the gym or whatever it is. You know, it takes like 5 seconds, but just that mental exhaustion of thinking, oh, what am I going to wear? What shorts? What pants? You know, what shirt? What socks? What shoes? Like, just all the decisions, you get mental exhaustion. That's what they call mental exhaustion. And you almost have what they call paralysis of analysis. I don't know if you heard that phrase. Paralysis of analysis. You have so many things to think about, you just, like, throw the whole thing out entirely. So that's what I think about this first part of the pasuk. Ki b'sach v'lo sasso chamo chamos. When you start thinking of all these strategies, you're just going to go at war. You're going to create tension and struggle internally, and it's not going to be healthy for you. So that's one way you can understand this pasuk. You could also understand that in a more positive sense, you could say that without strategy, you can never actually go to war. It's a harder tasso l'chamach. We have to read it a little differently, but you say tasso l'chamach when you have the forethought and planning. So then you're ready to go to war. That's how you could read it. It's a bit different. It's not that you made a war for yourself, but it's that you can now engage in a war.
Why can't I just look at it like you got a founder if you don't get the counsel? So you part saying, okay, you're on your own, now you screwed up, now you're getting counsel.
Yeah, it could be like that also. We haven't gotten the second part of the puzzle yet. But that's definitely part of the question is, what's the novelty in the first part of the puzzle? What does it mean that with strategy you make for yourself a war? Either you get yourself into war, like I said before, or it could be that you're ready for war. Now you can make for yourself a war because you've thought about it before.
Yeah.
I spoke to someone, and then I read something about this. Hold on. I think it was at the afternoon session 2 weeks ago at the Mental Health Shabbos. And at the end of it, we spoke about how if you have, and then I talked about it on my rabbinic retreat last week, that if you have your values in line, that if you really know who you are, you have strategized what your purpose in life is. That's not an easy thing to say. I mean, it's a lot easier to say that in one sentence than to actually achieve it. Right? If you've really thought about what you want from life, you've created your mission statement, so then you can go to war. Before you know what you want, it's very hard to go achieve it, right? I think a lot of us sort of, as Meir was saying, where we just flounder through life. Mm-hmm. And every day we come up with this decision, should I do this, should I do that? And we just don't really know what we want. And therefore, when we have those big decisions to make, we don't really have a clear guidance of what to do because we never decided for ourselves what are our true values. Right, so everyone's got to figure that, and they become more granular as you move down the chart. But obviously, you know, at the top would be doing what Hashem wants, and then from there, well, what does Hashem want for me? He wants me to have, you know, healthy relationships. He wants me to have a successful career. He wants me to contribute to the world. He wants me to take care of people. He wants me to take care of animals. Whatever it is, whatever we determine to be the values that Hashem wants from us in our life, so then we filter that into all of our decisions. And if there's something that comes to us which is not relevant, or even worse, against one of those values. So then those decisions become easy. You're sort of like a plug and play. Does this fit my mission statement or does it not fit my mission statement? Now, sometimes there's gray area. But more often than not, if you have delineated clearly what is and what isn't valuable to you, so then those decisions become better. And that's what I think it means here in the more positive sense. Keep it sachbolos. If you've strategized your life, if you've decided what's important in your life and what are the ways you're going to go about doing them, so then tahasalo chama chama. You can actually go out to war. You can actually make those decisions. So again, the first part of the pasuk is open interpretation. It could be either be you're overthinking things and you're making wars unnecessarily, or it could be once you've thought things through, right? So what the word tahasalot means. Once you've thought things through, so then you can actually go out to war. But in all cases, teshua berov yoetz. Teshua berov yoetz. And salvation comes with the abundance of counsel. Now the most fascinating part to me in this pasuk is the last word. Because the word right before the last word is berov. The word berov means with many, abundance.
Yes.
The word yoetz, however, means what? Counsel, singular. Right, usually rov is followed by a word in plural, right? Rov is abundance of something multiples. Abundance of toys, abundance of soldiers, abundance of tables, abundance of, right? The word abundance is usually precedes a pluralized noun. But here you have berov yoetz, with the abundance of counsel. Now counsel, at least literally, means one, right? One counsel.
Yeah.
So what does the abundance of counsel mean? There are different ways to understand this, of course, but perhaps what this is saying, and this is, you can also contrast this at the beginning of the pasuk too, perhaps what this is saying is sometimes there are too many cooks in the kitchen, right? You have tachbulos, tasal, chama, chama. When you have so much strategy, tachbulos, right, is in the plural. If you have so many multiple strategies, this general says you got to do this, this, and the other thing. And that general says, no, you have to do this, that, and the other thing. So then you're going to go to war because you have no idea what you want. Right? Before, this, you haven't delineated what exactly your unified purpose is. But teshua berov yoetz. When will you find salvation? When you have a singular one, the abundance of a singular focus. Now, what does the word abundance mean in that context? It's hard to figure out. But you could say the abundance of looking singularly at one counsel. This is what I'm doing. This is my mission statement. And you do that many times. So for that, you'll find salvation. If you have a unified approach, think about this in sort of like parenting styles. The father wants this for their kids. The mother wants that for their kids. And Rav Hirsch kind of points this out, the tension between Yitzchak and Rivka in raising Yaakov and Esau. Right? You see that in the Pesukim a little bit too. Yet Yitzchak had favored Esau for whatever reason, and Rivka favored Yaakov. And both of them were trying to give over the same sort of education to both kids. Just for Yitzchak, he clicked with Esau, and for Rivka's model, it clicked with Yaakov. But neither of them crossed to the other kid because they had different visions of what they wanted in their house. Which is, you know, not for now, but the point is for us that if you give mixed messages, so then it's very difficult for the child to create their own personal identity, right? One parent's pulling them in that way, one parent's pulling them in that this way, and that's b'tachvulot tasa l'chama chama. If there are so many strategies, the mother wants him to be a doctor, and the father wants him to be a lawyer, so then he's being pulled in both directions, and in the end of the day, he's going to be neither one. Because the other one doesn't want that one, the other one doesn't want that one. So that's milchama. Keep it tachbulot. If there are multiple strategies at play, so then you're going to just cause tension and strife. But the tshuva berov yoetz. But salvation comes when you have a singular message, when you have a singular identity, when you can hone in on what exactly is your purpose, what exactly is what you believe to be valuable in the world. Right? And if you can determine that, not easy. Again, easier said than done. Much easier. But if you can determine that yoetz, that singular counsel, that could be a person that's telling you how to do things, that could be yourself in your own mind telling you what you want from life, so then that's when you'll find Yeshua, that's when you'll find true salvation. So I believe we talked about that concept way back when. There was a piece from the Vilna Gaon who talked about generals at war and how you can't have too many generals. It's better to have one or two people that are in charge of the whole thing. And I found this many times in the shul also. You know, whenever you have a committee which is made up of like 10 people, nothing ever gets done. Either because there's so many voices and so many people have their own opinions, or because every person thinks the other person is going to take care of it. And in the end, they don't want to take care of it. And the only person that ever does is the person that's going to be blamed for it. And if there's no single person that's going to be blamed for it, so then no one's going to ever do anything. So I always like, you know, just recently we were trying to sort of create a new committee or revamp what was once a committee. And they asked, should we invite so-and-so? How many people should we have? I say invite nobody else. We've got a group of 3-4 people here that are willing to do the work. The more people you bring in, the less work we're getting done. Right? There's got to be some kind of bell curve or something that represents that. You know, the more it volunteers, the less work gets done. I don't know. But the point is that this pasuk, v'tach bulot ha'asav ha'chama, with the more strategies in the room, when there are more cooks in the kitchen, the less food actually gets prepared. However, teshua b'rov yoeis, when you can have a singular focus, so that will create more salvation in whatever difficulties you have. This pasuk doesn't seem to be... Yeah, sure enough.
Okay, so the word lecha.
Yes.
It's translated here as for your benefit.
Right. It does...
A whole different...
Right. So that's how I started it, which is that the word lecha is a tricky word. It either means you're making struggle for yourself in a bad sense, or you can go out to war, as I said before, if you have the proper strategies in place. So then, tasa lecha, go out and make a war, right? Go face those decisions that you need to make when you have the proper strategies in place. But yeah, there are different ways of understanding it, and a lot of it does tie to the word lecha, because the word benefit is not in the pasuk, right? The word benefit is not there. It's just the word lecha. They're translating the word lecha as benefit, but it could be something bad for you too. The word lecha just means for you. Now we know that Rashi famously says that the word lecha is for you. For benefit by lech lecha, right? Hashem says to Avram, go for you. Rashi says, lahanasta ulotovasta, for your benefit and for your goodness. So yes, there is precedent to say that the word lecha means a benefit, but in this case, it seems to me that it's more interpretation.
Could that mean victory?
Could it mean victory?
Victory, yeah. The victory comes with much planning.
Well, that's the second. You have the word victory? I don't.
Like you're winning something, you plan it.
I don't see that in the pasuk, but I.
It's a little translation.
I don't see that in the pasuk. That's an interesting translation. You have that in the art scroll?
No, the JPS.
Oh, there's a JPS.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see that. And art scroll doesn't translate that way either. Okay. Yeah, right. They're all basing it on different commentaries, uh-huh. Right? They're not just making it up. They're looking at the Malbim says it like this, and the Rashi says it like that. So everyone's got their own interpretation. This next pasuk doesn't seem like it has much to do with the previous pasuk, but what it means is Ramot le'avil chachmot. Ramot le'avil chachmot. Ramot is what do you have?
I think Ramah.
Ra'ama with an aleph in it apparently means some kind of gem. I don't know what other instance we have that. How do you translate?
It just says gem.
Gem, right. Ramot la'avil chachmos. That wisdom to a fool is like a gem. That's a very interesting phrase. How could wisdom be a gem to a fool? If anything, wisdom is looked down upon by the fool. So there are different types of fools. I think the next part of the pasuk is actually very informative to understand the first part. B'sha'ar lo yiftach piyu. At the entrance or the gate, they will not open their mouth. At the gate, they won't open their mouth. What do you have?
It says he will not open his mouth.
Yes, they or he, whatever. The fool won't open their mouth at the gate. What is the gate? And remember?
The gate.
The gate. No, that's an interesting one. The gate is presumed to be the meeting place to study. Now, it used to be that, you know, highways didn't have high-speed cars. They had people walking in and out, right? That's what a highway was. And the place where people would meet each other is at the entrance of the city, or the exit. That's where people are coming in, people going out. And if you ever wanted to meet someone, you would meet them at the gate. A lot of courthouses were by the gates of the city. People that are traveling in, they stop there at the gate. People are going out and stop at the gate. What was that?
Like Boaz?
Yes, that's just like Boaz. Yeah, that's what's coming up in Miklos Roth. Thank you, Marsha. So the gate was really a meeting place for a lot of things, and including Torah lectures. including rabbis, when they wanted to give a shir, they would do it at the gate. That's where people congregated. That's where things happened. So here, what it means, b'shar lo yiftach pihu, that at the gate, he won't open his mouth. Presumably what it means is that he's sitting in shir and he's unwilling to speak. Now, this is a different kind of foolishness. This is not a foolishness of a person who does the wrong thing. This is the foolishness of a person who lacks self-esteem and confidence. Because what he says is, Ramot le'avil chachmos. Wisdom is a gem. What is a gem? What's a gem? For anyone? Precious, good. Valuable, expensive, untouchable. It's almost something you put in a display case. A gem is something so precious, it's something that you don't touch. Right? That is, it's too precious to handle. So here, what it presumably means is Ramot la'avil chachmos, that the fool looks at wisdom as something which is untouchable and therefore unattainable. It's too precious. I can't possibly touch that. I can't possibly engage with that thing. And therefore, at the shir, at the rabbinic lecture, he just sits there with his mouth closed because he doesn't feel like he has a place to speak. He doesn't feel like he can engage. Why would he feel that way? Why would he feel like wisdom is untouchable, unattainable?
Insecurity.
Insecurity about what?
About his own, his image, his identity.
Okay, he doesn't think he's capable,
yeah.
Right? He lacks the confidence in his own abilities.
He's
good.
Okay,
he's afraid of failure, good.
Yeah. He doesn't know enough to voice an opinion.
He doesn't know enough, why doesn't he learn more?
Well, maybe he's not able to, or maybe he just doesn't have the opportunity.
Okay, able, opportunity, or maybe he feels like it's overwhelming.
Right.
Right, if you were to walk in here, right, sometimes this is my strategy with conversion candidates. You know, they come in, they say, Rabbi, I want to become Orthodox. I say, okay, fine. What do you think Orthodox means? And they gave me some line, you know, I was once at a Shabbos dinner and I loved it so much. I said, okay, let me tell you what it means to be Orthodox. Before we go down this rabbit hole of seeing whether or not you actually want to do it. You know, and I'll show them in my office or I'll bring them in here and I'll say, look at these bookshelves. Look at all those books. That's thousands of years of material. You really want to learn all that? And I'll go through it. This is the Tanakh. This is the history of the Jewish people and the laws of the Jewish people, and these books have commentaries upon commentaries. And then you go and you show them the Mishnah, and those books have commentaries. That's just the basics of the halakha. Then you go to the Gemara, which is the discussions of those basics, and even that Gemara has discussions on those discussions, commentaries. And then those commentaries have been filtered through generation after generation, thousands of books written just to figure out what those discussions mean. And then those have been codified into another whole set of books called the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch has commentaries upon commentaries trying to discuss what does the Shulchan Aruch mean? How did it posken? And those commentaries have then been filtered through into the modern-day applications of things that we do in electronics. And how does that Gemara, that Mishnah, that Pasuk, that commentary fit into a car? Right? How do we understand damages in the modern world when there's no tangible damage, but it's maybe intellectual damage or technological damage, you know, or if it's copyright infringement? Like, how do all of these things that never existed apply? And it's very complicated. And there are all these books. You really want to engage with all of that? It's probably better just not to be Jewish. Right? That's my job. My job is not to, you know, my job is to tell them not to be Jewish. Right? And they don't have to be. We believe that non-Jews have a place in the world and that they have a righteousness about them too. They do not have to be Jewish in order to gain merit. They don't have to be Jewish in order for it to go to the next world. In which case, I have to convince them not to do it. It's much easier for them to fulfill the role that they were given by Hashem than to try to adopt one which is so insurmountable. So I overwhelm them with the material. And perhaps that's what's going on here. Ramos lavo chachmos. Some fools, Jews, think to themselves, wow, this thing is too vast. This gem is too untouchable. It's too precious. I can't possibly handle that thing. But that's a fool's errand. Because that's what you say to a convert who doesn't have to be Jewish. But a Jew, instead of looking at the gem and saying it's unattainable, he says to himself, I'll make a couple dollars today and a couple dollars tomorrow. And slowly but surely, I'll be able to attain that gem. It'll take a long time. It'll take a lot of commitment in a consistent way. But I'm willing to do it. exactly like Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva sees the stone and the water is making a dent in the rock. And Rabbi Akiva says, if the water can break through stone, so too can the Torah break through my heart. And he starts to learn from the Aleph Beis, right?
He was
40 years old, and he made it all the way to being one of the greatest rabbis in history.
But you have helped some people convert.
Sure.
Being very difficult.
Yeah, yeah. That's part of me trying to show, trying to see if they're really in it, if they're really committed to it. Once they say, yeah, I want to take all that on, so then I'm like, okay, fine. We got a real fighter, someone who really wants it. Yeah, so for sure. Every situation is so individualized, so it's hard to make, you know, blanket statements about that, but yeah, every person is different. So here, you know, I don't know if it's on this pasuk, but I don't know if it quotes this pasuk, but there's a medrash in Vayikra which says that actually, it's in Vayakel. It's also on the pasuk in Nitzavim, right? The pasuk says, Lo v'ashamayim hi. The Torah is not in heaven. Right? Le'emor mi'ala lanu ha-shamayim ha-vikachel. And who's going to go up to heaven and get it for us? It's so far away from us. Rather, ki karav elach ha-davar mod. It's very close to you. Right? The Torah is very attainable. So the Medrash says on that pasuk, what is that compared to? It's compared to somebody who sees a loaf of bread hanging in the sky. It doesn't say what it's hanging from. And two guys come upon this loaf of bread hanging in the sky, and one guy says, that thing is so high up in the air, there's no way I can get that. I'm out of here. I'd rather give up on it. And he just goes home. The other guy says, this is what the measure says, the other guy says, well, if it's there in the sky, somehow it must have gotten there. And he goes and he finds a ladder, and he puts the ladder out, and he climbs up all the steps and he gets a piece of bread. So the measure says, you know, Lamal Davidol, that's what is that analogous to? Someone who walks into the base measure and sees all the books and says, wow, those books are so unattainable. They're so far away. They're so, you know, far from my intellectual capacity or my skill set or my, you know, my time commitment. I'm just going to give up on the whole thing and go home. Whereas the other guy comes in and says, that's a lot of books. I better start opening the pages. And he reads a couple pages a day, chapter a day. And slowly but surely, he makes a dent. As the Mishnah in Avo says, Lo alecham lacham ligmor, it's not upon you to finish the work, but at the same time, you're not a free man to just say, all right, enough with it, to give up on it. We all have to do whatever we can do. So that's what the fool says here. The fool says, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. I can't do all of it, so I'm going to do none of it. I can't get the bread, so I'm not even going to try. And he just gives up. Because he sees it as a gem. He sees it as unattainable and, you know, untouchable. It's like supposed to be in a glass case somewhere. I can't touch it. Either out of confidence or lack of confidence or out of, you know, his own sort of being intimidated by it. Either way, he feels intimidated. And therefore, even when there's a rabbi speaking to him, there's a rabbi giving shir, giving a class, he can't bring himself to open his mouth. The rabbi's right there, but he feels so ashamed, so lacking in self-esteem and lacking in confidence, he feels he can't even approach the rabbi to ask him a question. And sometimes that's on the rabbi. Sometimes that's the rabbi's fault to not make himself approachable. But the person has to be willing to ask the question. And that's certainly a lesson that I learned in school. I've always been a quiet student. Sometimes because of apathy, I didn't care for what I was learning, but also because, you know, I was always embarrassed, you know, raising my hand, asking a question, it's a bad question. And I remember I had a professor in college, I was probably already past that apprehension once I got into college, but I remember the professor always reminded us at the beginning of every semester, he used to say, if you have a question in mind, trust me, somebody else is asking it. No matter how silly it sounds, somebody else in the class has the same question. And how true it is, like, we go through life pretending, you know, pretending like we know things that we don't realize everybody else doesn't know either. You know, like, how many people actually know? I remember when I did this, like, you know, buying a house, you know, and you know, trying to figure out what it means to get a mortgage and what the different rates mean and everything. And, like, I felt like I had to pretend like I knew what I was talking about because, like, it's so ubiquitous. the concept of a mortgage and how it works was like everyone talks about them. I just felt like I'm supposed to know this. I can't ask anybody about it. I just was, 8 years ago when I was first buying a house. But like you feel like that. We're just random situations in life, you know.
We just get intimidated.
We intimidate ourselves because a lot of the times it's not really true. It's not true that everybody else knows those things. And if you have that thought, it means somebody else also has that thought. I grew up my childhood friends were very smart. Like, they got, 1400s on their SATs rolling out of bed. Right? They're just very smart people. And I felt oftentimes very intimidated because, I sort of grouped myself with them, but I wasn't nearly as street smart as them or book smart as them. And it was like, I don't know if I developed that or it was sort of like a natural thing that I was so apprehensive to like speak up and to talk about things that were like their domain. Like they know those things and I don't know these basics. Like they would make references to things that I didn't really know what they were talking about. Happens in Hebrew also. Someone says a Hebrew word and you feel like, oh, that sounds like a word I should know. So I'm not going to ask what it means, you know? But we shouldn't feel like that. That's what this fool does. The fool says, oh, that's a gem that I'm inadequate to touch. I'm inadequate to engage with. And therefore, Bashar lo yiftachtiu in shir, in class, when the instructor is there to instruct, he doesn't even feel like he can open his mouth. This, by the way, is my interpretation of the Eini Yode Lishol. People translate the fourth kid in the Seder, the Eini Yode Lishol, as the one who doesn't know how to ask. For some reason, we all put the word how in there. There's no word how in the phrase. Eino yodea lishol does not mean doesn't know how to ask. That would be eino yodea eich lishol. It doesn't say eich lishol. It says eino yodea lishol. He doesn't know enough to ask. Doesn't know enough means he feels inadequate. He doesn't know enough that he's even justified in asking questions. Because I know so little, it would be a waste of everybody's time to ask that question. I know so little that like everybody knows that. Right? That's Eino Daily Show. Doesn't know enough to feel comfortable asking. Right? Doesn't know enough to ask. Now sometimes that means you have to know something in order to ask anything. But that depends on the context. So that's what it means here. To have the confidence to speak up for yourself. Okay, Ches 8:24:8. Mechashev Lahareya. Lo Baal Mezimos Yikrael. There's a very interesting truff marks here. I know people are familiar with how the truff works here. But when it comes to the mark underneath the word Lahareya, I don't know if you can see it. It's like an upside down Y almost.
And that wishbone.
Yeah, like a wishbone, yes. So that's called a etnachta. It often will denote a hard comma or even a semicolon, sometimes even a period. It's like the end of a phrase. Mechashev lahareya. Stop. And then, lo baal mezimos yikro. The reason why you have to say it like that is the word lahareya means that you're not actually doing anything wrong, but you're thinking of doing something wrong. Mechashev lehareya. You are thinking or computing, calculating to do something wrong. But it doesn't say to who, it doesn't say to what. You don't actually tangibly do anything. So the word lo is not going on lehareya. It's not going, you thought about doing something wrong to a person, but you just thought about doing something wrong. So lo, to that person, baal mezimos yikro. To that person, they will call him a schemer. How do you translate that word? How do you translate that phrase, Mayor? Baal mezimos yikro.
Back to A.A.K. Master of Wicked Designs?
Yeah, what do they call him?
Wicked Designs.
Master of Wicked Designs?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, he'll get that reputation of being a master of wicked designs. Okay, interesting translation there.
Jim, what's that,
what you say
in that one?
What is it?
A schemer.
A schemer? He'll be called a schemer? All right. Same type of thing. The point here is you don't even have to do anything to be known as a schemer. You don't have to do anything. You could be somebody who just thinks about things, who ponders things. You never did anything wrong to anybody. People can still figure it out. right? There are some people that whatever they do, they always find a way to make it okay. But everybody knows their intentions, right? Everybody knows that they're not that they're not doing it for sincere motives, right? You know those people, you know. I remember classmates growing up. You know, they would always find a way to cut corners, to not take a test, to always be out in the hallway at the right times. You know, but I'm going to the bathroom. The teacher said it was okay, right? But come on, you're not actually, you know, following the spirit of the law. You're getting by the letter of the law. So here, mechashev laharei, I think about that also. You're thinking about doing something wrong. You never do anything wrong, but you're thinking about doing something wrong. And even if you don't do anything wrong, lo ba mezimos yikro, people will call you the master of, what was it? What did you say, Mayor?
Designs.
Master of designs. This schemer. This guy who's always concocting such plans. We know what he's up to, even if he never does anything wrong. Even if he does anything wrong, people will notice that. Right? People can figure that out just by, you know, sometimes we play this game where we pretend like, you know, people are not bad people just because they never did anything. But we know people like that. What's your
thing? Bernie Madoff started out like that, but then he saw he could get away with it.
Okay.
And he got worse.
Maybe this is where it starts.
Nice.
The question here is, do people know something's wrong with Bernie Madoff before he did anything wrong? That's harder to say. Mm-hmm. Right? But there are, you know, sleazy people. You can just tell they're sleazy. Have they ever been convicted of a crime? No, but, you know, they're sleazy people. You know, I'm sure you can think of people in your life. But that's what it means. Just being that kind of person, people will call you that. People will call you that thing, even if you've never done it. Because...
Waiting for the exchange rate to be in their favor before they return money.
Okay.
Like,
but then you actually do it. But,
yeah, you
I don't know.
But I guess that's...
Yeah. But... Yeah, I'm thinking more about the person's intentions when they do something, right? Mm-hmm. They do the technical right thing, but they weren't doing it because of the right thing. They were doing it because they wanted something for themselves. Mm-hmm. They give tzedakah so that they could have their name on a wall or a plaque or, mm-hmm. you know, name something after themselves. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, you did the right thing and yeah, it was legal and yeah, people will give you a pat on the back. But if you did it for the pat on the back, so that's not really a great thing.
Yeah, it's like the different levels of tzedakah.
Yeah.
The one with wants the recognition and the other one who does
right.
do it simply without it anonymously.
Obviously. Yeah, there are different levels of it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's a hard thing to pin down, but that's what it means here. I think we often wait for somebody to do something in order to give them their flowers or their consequences. But more often than not, that what they do is not always an accurate portrayal of who they are. Sometimes we get caught up with externalities, and people that do a lot of things are not necessarily the best people, and people that do very few things are oftentimes better. They just don't have the resources, time, or energy to do all the things that are natural to their good-natured, you know, persona. Either way, zima sivas chasas v'savas la'adam leis pasuk. Test number 9.
Wait, but didn't you talk that long ago once about nothing wrong with thinking on this line as long as you're thinking about it? I thought we discussed that.
Say that again.
Once.
If you're thinking the wrong thing?
Yeah, if you're thinking you're doing something wrong, as long as you don't act upon it.
Depends what it is.
I thought so.
I don't remember speaking about that recently,
yeah.
But I definitely mentioned that once in a Hasidic class.
Yeah.
But not recently.
Okay.
Either way.
But you can't say thinking is as bad as actions. I mean,
no,
correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it depends what it is. Here we're talking about person's intentions to do something bad to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a problem. Either way, zimas ivelas chatas. What is the fool's scheme? A foolish design is a sin. Zimas ivelas chatas. It's a sin even to design. That those two can go together, obviously. The person who devises evil and the foolish design are the same. That it's sinful even to plan it. Now, what's the difference between this and the previous pasuk? The previous pasuk is other people will pick up on it, right? Lo ba'mezimos yikreo, people will call him a schemer. Here, what we're saying is that that schemer will be tantamount to a sinning. Now, that's a loaded phrase. As Meir just said, Hashem's not going to punish you for something you didn't do.
Yeah.
So that's why the word chatas is a tricky word here, because it's hard to say that you actually did a chatas in the biblical sense, meaning that you sinned. But I think what it means is that Hashem knows what your schemes are, and he'll consider it to be something wrong. Apparently the Ralbag uses the word chatas here not as the word sin, but as a miss or a lacking. That zimas ivelas chatas, he turns the whole thing on its head. He doesn't say that the evil, the fool scheme is a sin, but rather he says zimas ivelas chatas, scheming to the fool is a sin. Meaning that the fool thinks, oh, I don't have to plan it out. I don't have to sort of think it through, because that, who needs that stuff? I'm just going to go act on impulse. Right? So the word zimas could be a negative or a positive. And here we're saying that it's a positive, that the fool doesn't want to do plan. Right? Doesn't want to plan things out beforehand. Which connects to what we said at the beginning of class today. But zimas ivelas chatas, that the planning, the necessary planning is lacking in the fool. The necessary planning is lacking in the fool. V'so'avas l'adam leitz, and leitz is like a clown or a scoffer, a mocker. A scoffer, right? A scoffer is abominable. So this is different. This is different because before we were talking about how the schemer who wants to do something but never does it is held accountable for it. Either by other people will know they're a schemer, or the scheme is going to be considered like a sin. Here, we're not even talking about their own scheme. We're talking about what information they will make fun of. Because it's one thing to do a bad thing, it's another thing to take someone's good thing and then make fun of it. Right? Those are two different things. A person could plan to do something wrong, and that's wrong. But when he hears somebody else's plan to do something right, and then makes fun of it, right, belittles it, so that not only gets rid of a good thing, it also makes it a bad thing. Right? So for instance, you know, keeping it simple here, the rabbi talks about the importance of giving charity. And then somebody comes along with a quick joke. Oh, charity, you know all that money goes to the worthless causes. They never use it for good things. So now not only have you gotten rid of the message of the rabbi, now you've made charity into a bad thing, right? So that's what it means here. So I'll ask them late that it's abominable when a person is a scoffer. When he takes a good thing and he makes fun of it, it creates so much damage that sometimes it's even worse than, you know, doing something wrong. If an evil person does something wrong, it's okay. He's clearly doing the wrong thing. But if he takes a good person's good deed and makes it into a bad deed, so then people aren't going to think much of the good person either. Right? So the evil guy's evil and the good person's evil. Right? Because of the way the person thought about it, the person spoke about it. And that's why it's a little more pernicious. Let me see here. It says, scoffing person makes repugnant to God and man, even if the scoffer merely engages in ridicule, but does not actually do anything wrong, he is an abomination. Right? So that's where it connects to what we said before, that he's not doing anything. He's just making fun of something somebody else is doing. That's also a problem. Okay, one more pasuk here. Hitrafisa. If you were like weak, I don't know if that's how you translate it.
Yeah,
that's what it is. Hitrafisa b'yamsara. Sar kochecha, interesting spelling of the word kochecha there. But if you are weakened in another's day of affliction, your strength will become limited. Is that how you have it? Sar kochecha. It will narrow your own strength.
I got the same translation you have.
Both are cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, what does JPS have for number 10?
If you show yourself slack in time of trouble, wanting in power. If you refrain from rescuing those taken off to death, those condemned to slaughter,
Okay, so these are, according to the JPS, is one long sentence, the next three psukim, which is possibly could read like that. We're talking basically about three similar things. We'll pick it up next week, but basically like this, how do you respond to difficulties? Now, according to the art scroll, this first pasuk is on its own. It's an independent statement. Hitrapisa biyom sarah. You're confronted with a difficult situation. If in those difficult situations you become weak, so then sar kochecha, you'll be weak next time too. Right? When something is challenging you, and in the face of that challenge you cower, and you don't take it head on, you don't confront it, embrace the challenge, and try to overcome it, so then the next time you have a challenge, you'll be even weaker in your approach. Sar kochecha means you will have trained your instincts to not be willing, to be apprehensive, to be less confident in your abilities. Now, this goes in the opposite direction also. We've talked about this recently. If you can embrace a challenge, confront it, and overcome it, then the next time you have that same challenge or a similar challenge, you'll be much more willing, much more confident to approach it and to get over that hump. You know, this is something I've talked about before, but when I was in Kansas, think about it, just I spoke to someone today from Kansas, that when I was in Kansas, one of the main reasons I wanted that job was because it's a soft floor, right? You play in a place like Kansas, everyone just appreciates your being there and helping out. But also, all of the experiences. You know, if I were to take an assistant rabbi position in a big shul in New York City or in Columbus, I was going to be, you know, I was looking at a job in Columbus. So then I would get like these menial tasks. You know, I'd be the stucco collector, or I'd be, you know, I'll give the halacha chabur after davening. But I wouldn't do the real heavy lifting stuff. When I go to Kansas, so it's all hands on deck. They don't have that many rabbis to do all of the responsibilities. So I got real experience. And the reason that I wanted to do that was so that when I would get a real rabbinic position, a head rabbinic position, I'd have a certain confidence about, oh, I've been here, done that before. I've done funerals before. I've done weddings before. I've done, you know, sermons before. I've done some counseling before. I've done fundraising before. I've spoken to other rabbis already. So even if it wasn't necessarily that I had my entire skill set, it, you know, the water wasn't freezing cold, you know? I put my foot in the water already. And it gave me sort of the confidence to say, I can do this kind of thing next time I have to approach it. Even if it was more daunting the next time, the fact that I'd done it before, means that it was, comfortable for me to get into it. So here, when it says, Hitra Pisa Biyam Sara, when you have that challenge, and instead of embracing it, going forth and trying to conquer it, whether it was, you know, conquerable or not, instead of doing that, you cowered. You dodged the fight. You avoided the conflict. So then the next time around, you're not going to have as much strength. Sar kochecha. You won't have that ability, that confidence, to go forth with the next challenge. Always have to be very careful not to back away from challenges. And even if that means, you know, sometimes losing the challenge, at least you fought, right? Instead of avoiding the conflict, you are willing to fight. That will allow you to embrace the next time too, depending how you compute or how you digest process that challenge. So it all depends on how you react. But the point here is, when you get into tension, when there's a moment of tension, the way we should look at it is not, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? But rather, okay, this is hard, this is difficult, but I'm going to go head first. I'm going to go right at it. I'm not going to cower. And that's what it means here. If you do cower, so you're going to lose that strength. I remember when we first started this Mishnah class, I gave an analogy that I saw in a book. I forgot what book it was already by now. But was it in a book? I don't remember. The analogy of the grade school teacher who's trying to convince his kids why they should learn math. Remember this analogy? The kids, what am I ever going to need math? I have a calculator. So the teacher says to them, okay, there are situations maybe you'll need to know what you're doing. That's true. There are so many calculators in the world that you're probably not going to miss one. But the point is that he said to them, well, let me ask you something. Do you go to the gym? I said, yeah, of course we go to the gym. He said, do you lift weights at the gym? He said, yeah, of course we lift weights. I said, why do you lift weights? They said, well, to be stronger. I said, what do you mean be stronger? How is, when you ever, are you anticipating that one time in your life there's going to be somebody who takes a barbell and sticks it on top of you and says, you know, if you don't lift this, I'm going to kill you? Mm-hmm. That will never happen. And yet you're lifting weights. What does the weight have to do with anything? So the teacher's point to the child was that the analogy is, I'm not teaching you math because sometime you're going to have some very difficult life situation where you're going to have to crunch numbers. You might, but you can use a calculator. What I'm teaching you is to build up your muscles. And if you don't build up your muscles, so then the next challenge that you'll have, you're not going to want to use your muscle. You're not going to have the muscle available to use for the next challenge. So you lift weights, which has nothing to do with any practical value, so that there's something else that's going to require physical strength, that you can do that thing. But if you don't do the lifting of the weights, if you're not willing to do the math problems, so you're not going to have the intellectual capabilities to take on the next challenge. So here also, histra pisa biyom tzara, if whether when there's a tension of any kind, of any challenge, and you cower away from it, and you don't engage with it, so the next time something else happens, completely irrelevant, completely different, could be a completely different topic, a completely different genre of challenge. But the last challenge you had, you cowered from it. So you're gonna have a lot less willingness, a lot more apprehension to engage the next challenge. So that's the first stage of these three psukim, mm-hmm. which is really a continuous theme that Mirz Hashem will continue after Shavuos. Next week we'll do Legends and Lessons.
Oh,
Mirz Hashem, after Shavuos, we'll do Mishlei again. Yeah, believe it or not, here it comes.
All right.
Okay. Everyone should have a good night.
Yeah.